Off the Ball, GAA.
Well, we are talking about it, like, well, you're not talking about the incident, you're talking about the fact that that out of 50 people, you're finger pointing me, is that what you're saying?
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
And I want to start with Man United every day, so this is one of the few days where we might actually just do that.
That's actually a blatant lie. I want to start with Celtic every day.
Fair enough, yeah.
But if we start with Man United second, then we're happy out. Although the Arsenal fans, we are joined by one today, we should say.
Maybe we start there.
I think it's a good way to start out, isn't it?
Happy now.
A happy man. What a season. And more to look forward to.
When did you think you were going to bottle it the most?
Oh, it's so funny, isn't it, how you can go through a full season playing the way they did and then for the pressure to come on. And that was always going to be the case, I think, after the last, three, 4 years of being in contention.
And 20 years, really. We can't underestimate the fans in particular, them being terrified of this happening or not happening. When you finally have a team that's good enough and everything else around you is like falling apart, all you have to do is just keep going. And for the fans, it did feel like they were kind of transmitting their anxiety onto the team in a way.
100%. But I think it transcends any team that's looking to get over the line for so long, for that period of time and being so close so often. It's just about getting over the line. And I remember like listening to the boys and Roy Keane and these pundits and saying that their style of play had diminished. Of course it has. Because you're so close to something that you've wanted for so long. Like this Mikel Arteta, like I was looking back at some of the players that he's gone through and like the Per Mertesacker of the and Mathieu Monreal and these guys that were just insane how they ever wore an Arsenal jersey to the team that is there now.
Yeah.
But I often think that a team like this, that next season comes and they just throw off the shackles because they've done it now once. And it's like a Rory McIlroy with the Masters, that he can now throw off the shackles and now you see him playing with that kind of freedom. And I'd hope that Arsenal will do that. And even I'd be hopeful that, you know, this Saturday in the Champions League final, that it'd be the same thing. That now that you have that monkey off the back of a Premier League and maybe not having won that going into this Champions League final, I was worried about. But now having that, you have that to fall back and you have your Champions League just playing with complete and utter freedom. I'm really looking forward to that on a Saturday.
And there have been little elements of it. Like, I think we had this conversation already. People are saying that the most important player for the whole season was Rice, and he played really well. And obviously Raya was really important. But actually it was the supporting cast this year when Saka was injured. Previous years it would have been, if Martinelli played well for 10 games, that was great, but he would get injured. And then they signed Trossard and then they did a little bit of depth there. And then this year they had, Havertz went out, but they had Gyökeres to come in. So nobody thinks Gyökeres won the league on his own, but having subs who could come in and play at a level that was at a good enough level to survive. And then Saka comes back and he's been fit for the last 5 or 6 weeks and he looks completely transformed from the player who was grand for most of the season.
100%. It's benefited him that he came into a team that were in the position that they were in. But I also think as well, you're looking at a Premier League team and any other team, you're looking at that competition for places. And that's obviously a factor with Arsenal, that they have competition for places. But I think that the Premier League season is so long and you've so many other competitions to contend with, FA Cup, Carabao Cup, Champions League, that you need essentially 2-11 teams that you can kind of interchange and intermix, that you can say to yourself, this 11 is going out today. And it's not necessarily competition, but it's just people that can go out on any given day that you need to pull back players in Carabao Cup game or in an FA Cup game because you have a big important Champions League game or Premier League game coming down the line. So I think Mikel Arteta was brilliant at that. But it just goes to show that managers need that time as well. Like, you're looking at some managers coming in, you look at Ange Postecoglou coming into the Spurs and these guys that get, 5-6 games, doesn't work. Okay, we're gone, we're on to the next. Like, Arteta's there 8 years.
Yeah.
You're saying to yourself, this man has, he was given the trust. I understand that, you know, maybe these smaller clubs that are just vying for Premier League glory or, you know, looking to get into that top half of the Premier League, it's a different case. But I do think that, you know, there's a case in point now with Arteta for the time he's been given and the success he's had and please God, into the future, we'll have that. There's maybe your blueprint for what other Premier League clubs can follow.
Yeah, Kieran McGeaney at Armagh.
Exactly, 100%. And there is these, you know, people that have, and like I suppose Jim McGuinness for, you know, with Donegal, that he came, had success, went, came back, and has had success since as well. And, you know, is providing a team with a platform to build upon as well. So I think that there's definitely case in point in terms of giving that manager that time frame and that, I suppose, leeway to do what he can do.
I think the parallel with Donegal as well, the first year, was it the second year when they actually had a bit of success and they were the ultra defensive team. The year after, they layered on some extra attacking threats and ended up winning the All-Ireland. It's like, I really hope you're right about that, because it would be great if Arsenal were able to defend and had excellence at set pieces, but actually unleashed Max Downman and Saka and Havertz in whatever position he's going to be in, and even sign a better striker still, because they'll be signing from a position of strength now.
100%. And you're looking at, if they were to go into the market again, what kind of calibre of player they'd be attracting now.
Yeah.
The one that always baffled me was that these players, you know, United are looking, and for the last couple of years are kind of petering down the table, but we're still able to attract these huge names of people that wanted to play for United. And you'd hope that Arsenal would be in a position now where they could attract these, you know, world-class players, because... Yeah. I suppose Jokeres, really, when he was signed, was an unknown entity. Yeah, he had done it in the Portuguese league, but in terms of doing it on the big stage, yeah, he played against City and scored hat-tricks, and that was fine. But it was risky.
Yeah,
that was, in essence, the premise on what he was signed upon, was literally those performances against Manchester City. So for him to have performed how he did this season, for such a big price tag to be put on him, and it takes a player like that to get up to pace. And it also takes the Arsenal team to get up to pace with him, because they've never played with an out-and-out striker,
yeah,
ever. It was always with a false nine or however else they set up. Havertz was never an out-and-out striker as well. So in terms of how they played and how they utilised them, but you could see as the season went on that they used him a hell of a lot better, and even just that high ball out to get out of that kind of high press that oppositions were setting on him, he was able to hold it up, and he's come into his own. And even in the last couple of games when he's come off a bench, he's done so, so well at that.
Yeah, okay. So you love Arteta?
I love Arteta. Arteta in.
Will we talk about Bruno?
Yeah, we do have some Man United news, which is
this
interesting.
Isn't news. This is pure soap opera.
Well, yeah, gossip. That's true. It's not really news, but it is. It's fun, is what it is. So, as we know, Bruno Fernandes broke the assist record at the weekend. Marginally, you would say, could have been easily given as an own goal, but I think they just held their hands up. He posted this bizarre video. I don't know if you've seen it after the fact. Of Thierry Henry's jersey on a washing line, Kevin De Bruyne's jersey on a washing line, and then Bruno Fernandes' jersey going up to symbolise, following the steps of giants, is essentially the message that he was putting out, which is extremely high performance, you would say, of him, which is interesting because that's where he then ended up on one of these high performance podcasts with Stephen Bartlett. And Roy Keane came up in conversation. Roy Keane obviously was quite dismissive of Bruno's chasing of this assist record on the Stick to Football podcast. So this is what Bruno had to say about Roy Keane's words.
Recently, Roy Keane criticised your mentality based on a quote he got completely backwards. He claimed you said, "I should have shot, but I made the passes," and used that to suggest that you were chasing individual assist stats. But everyone who actually listened to the interview, including myself, knows you said almost the exact opposite. You were being self-critical of yourself and saying you should have passed the ball instead of shot because you wanted the best for your team. How do you respond to that? Like, how do you deal with that when you hear it and you go, "That's not what I said"?
Yeah, to be honest, like I've always said, I don't mind criticism. I've always take criticism from everyone and anyone, and I never replied to anything or whatsoever. People have an opinion, they think it's good, bad, whatever. What I don't like is when people lie about things. And this case that you said about Roy Keane, basically what he said is a lie. And luckily for me, is everything on record. Imagine if he wasn't, like, then people will think like, oh yeah, Bruno is the guy always trying to got the assist. I even asked Ole his number to text him, to be honest, to have a word with him to say like, that I don't mind the criticism. I don't like when people lie about things that I say, because this is like, it goes a little bit over the top of the things that I think are acceptable.
Keane's wrong, right? People have dug out the interview and he did say, there were probably moments today when I should have passed instead of shot.
Yeah, I'm not so sure he lied as much as he maybe misheard and then jumped to a conclusion off the basis of getting it wrong, which is, you know, it's not as bad as lying, but it's also not great if you're going that hard on someone.
Yeah, it's a mistake.
But the worst part about it was he went in on him.
Yeah.
It was literally 15 minutes of a rant on Bruno and he's chasing. And I understand, I suppose, Roy's dismay at it as well, because that's an individual accolade and that's fine if that's, you know, a Golden Boot or if that's a Player of the Year award or if that's Ballon d'Or spec. But it's an assist record. As in, is it even a record?
I mean, it is now. It's like, you know...
I just thought it was a stat. I didn't even know like that it was so highly thought of. And yeah, again, taken out of context. But again, I feel like it's a very individualistic award. And Bruno's spoken openly about wanting State United to win trophies. Brilliant, amazing. That's his mentality, I suppose. Just makes Roy Keane look like a little bit of a... that he jumped the gun, I suppose, a small bit on...
Well, he actually bit back... at Bruno Fernandes. You don't associate Roy Keane with a social media guy, but he's when he posts on Instagram,
he
knows what he's doing. So he actually posted a picture. I don't know if we have it here, but it's a picture of a donkey, and in the background you can kind of see lions looking at him, and it says, "Too much attention makes a donkey think he's a lion." So is he talking about Bruno there? Is Bruno the donkey? I presume that's what he's insinuating. I find it very weird, this whole Roy Keane, Bruno Fernandes thing, because I understand what Roy's saying, and Roy Keane's thoughts is always with the team and always with putting the team first. And you see that with what Gary Neville speaks about, and Roy Keane always putting the team first. But if anything, I would have thought Bruno Fernandes would be Roy Keane's exact type of player, because he is mentally the best player at United, as well as being literally their best player. And if you put Bruno into a better side, like he's a winner. Like he literally does what Roy Keane wants players to do. He scraps for wins. I know he complains a lot, but he's doing that because he wants to win as much as you'd say Roy Keane wanted to win. So I don't know.
Do you love Bruno as a Man United fan? Do you love him?
I think he's the best player that has played for United since the Alex Ferguson era, and he's the most competitive player that has played at United, and he's the exact type of player you want at your club.
So you do love him?
I wouldn't say I love him, but I like him as a player.
But I think that feeds into Bruno's mentality as well. Bruno was always associated with being the best player at a poor United team. I think that suited Bruno down to the ground, because Bruno always got the headlines when United were doing well. And similarly, Bruno, when United were doing poorly, it was the team around Bruno wasn't good enough. So Bruno was winning either way. And I always thought that suited Bruno. And now that United are starting to do well, and, you know, Acuna is stepping up, and Mbeumo is stepping up, and, you know, Kobbie Mainoo has come back into the middle of the field, it's taken a little bit of the limelight off of Bruno, and hence there's a couple more interviews with
Bruno. Sitting down.
Here we go.
Yeah,
here we
Stephen go. Bartlett, he'll be on the high performance one next week. And why did he never nail down a position starting for Portugal?
It's a tricky one. Like, from a discipline perspective, I can completely see why people see the shortcomings of Bruno, because positionally he runs away and he's impossible to manage in that aspect.
And is that not what Keane is actually? That remember, maybe you're not old enough, but there's a England draw 2-2. David Beckham scores a 95th. There's a 96th minute free kick against Greece, and everybody goes, "Oh, it's David Beckham's dragged England to the World Cup." But the proper football journalists were like, Why was it 2-2 at that stage? It was because Beckham was literally running around like a headless chicken, leaving these massive gaps where he was supposed to be. And, you know, there's the Messiah complex that comes, as you're talking about, with players like Bruno. Yeah. And I don't know.
I think it's probably similar enough to the Coutinho situation in Liverpool, where, you know, maybe if you sold Bruno for 150 million a few years ago, you could have supplemented the team a lot better and made the team better. So, like, there is that.
Maybe
there
now
definitely is that argument.
On that point, right, Alan Connolly is talking in all the papers today, and this is in the Indo, but it's also carried in the Examiner and the Cork Echo and everywhere else as well. He finished with 11 points, including 8 frees, but he's not talking about scores here. I just want to get the lines right. That's what we're kind of chasing, all right, he says, talking about the energy that a successful tackle can feed into the team. I don't really care about the scoring. None of us does as forwards. It's more about work rate, tackles and turnovers now. That's all we'll be looking at when we look back at it. It won't be about who scored what, who was man of the match or anything like that. There are no individuals here. We just want a good team effort. I think all of us are working really hard this year, and it starts up top with me, Hayes and William. The lads who are coming in are adding to that. The backs are fine as well. Powerful stuff.
Yeah, come here. I get the sense that that is true. I do get the sense that it is true because there seems to be, I don't want to say it, I suppose for lack of a better word, a steeliness or a grit about this Cork team that in years gone by, Cork at this stage of the year would have been winning games by 10, 12 points at their ease. And the hype train would have been building in Cork. The hype train within the camp would have been building and players would have been feeding into that. I do sense there's a mentality change.
Yeah.
I do sense that Bin has probably brought something a little bit different to that. I suppose maybe based off his own playing career in terms of, you know, him being one of the leading lights but never maybe stealing the limelight because of that. There's definitely something that's there that they've added in that. But again, I suppose there's long telling in that then as well because, you know, I would never have associated Cork as, you know, a turnover team or a team that would turn over and celebrate. Didn't see too much of that at the weekend and haven't seen too much of that over the last couple of games as well. So whether that's actually the fact or whether that's maybe something that they're striving to get to maybe and just maybe change that whole cultural shift within the Cork dressing because it very much was an individual basis that Cork based a lot of their success.
Yeah, they were a team of Brunos and now they're not.
A team of Brunos.
That's what they're trying
exactly,
to be.
Exactly, yeah.
It's interesting, it's Patrick Horgan on the back of the Examiner this morning. His column, the headline is, O'Connor's claim that previous Cork teams didn't work hard struck me as odd. And it's just kind of, it's like the fourth, top of the fourth one. After the game, Ben O'Connor said Cork had been known down through the years as having nice players who didn't work hard and he would only play lads who would work hard. I don't know if I agree with Ben there. Because it suggests previous management teams put up with fellas who didn't try, or that his current players are trying hard now but didn't in the past. That struck me as odd, given most of the team he has now have won Munster finals, league finals, and reached two All-Ireland finals. You don't get to that level without trying hard.
And I'd fully agree. And that's a strange. I thought it was a strange comment. Was that more of a dig at management team and their style of managing players and getting the most out of those players? Or was that a dig? Because as you said,
it's definitely a dig though. Well,
and then maybe is Patrick Horgan picking that up as a dig at him because he's the only player that has maybe parted ways. You know, you're looking at players like Seamus Harnady that has maybe stepped off of the boil a little bit and there's younger players coming through. And again, they're more of his cohort that came through the 20s with Ben. So is it more of a plaudit to him and a I suppose a diss on what's gone before him in terms of John Myler and with Pat Ryan. But I thought that was strange because that group that's there.
It seems unnecessary, right?
Unnecessary.
When you're trying to bring everybody with you. But look, he's definitely been ploughing his own furrow since the very first time he went on TG Carr after one of the league games and was like, right, new sheriff in town.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to roll in here or ship up or ship out. The other way around. Does this help? Is that like fostering some kind of extra team spirit that they didn't have?
Do you know what? I feel like what Cork are putting out in the media, I don't think they're buying into the whole point. Like even back, going back to what Alan Connolly said, you know, we're going to win it all, the league, the Munster and the All-Ireland. And then that didn't happen. And then it was like, okay, we forget about that. So I feel like that what's being portrayed in the media, maybe it could be a really shrewd operation in terms of what they're portraying outwardly isn't what's actually being said within the camp. And if that's the case, that's a really shrewd thing to do from Ben O'Connor and his management team and also the player group. Because, yeah, these kind of... If I was a player and I was, you know, had reached what Patrick Horgan said is two All-Ireland finals, league finals, Munster finals, had success in a couple of those, and I was being told that I didn't work hard in any of those, I'd take that as a chip on my shoulder. I'd have a problem with that. But again, I think that was maybe pointed more at management team, management styles that went before him, that they didn't put the onus on that
hard work,
that it was the scores that mattered. And like down through the years, when we ever played Cork, we always felt it was going to be a shootout. It was going to be who could score the most. And that was literally the way it went. It was never, you know, your most dogged fight that you had against the Clare, where you came out physically battered and bruised, against the Tipperary, against the Waterford. It was always, they were lovely hurlers. They had really good, like they were unbelievable stickmen, something to admire, and they still are. But they've definitely added that maybe that grit and determination, and like they've conceded, I think between Cork and Limerick, they've conceded the least amount of goals in this year's championship. So that obviously ties into that point as well about that steel and that grit.
Yeah. Okay. If anybody out there has any thoughts on any of this, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number.
Yep, and we will be talking about the Munster Hurling Championship later on with Seamus and more about Limerick, but we want to talk about Limerick's biggest fan at the minute, and that's US Ryder Cup captain Jim Furyk, who was in Ireland over the last couple of weeks. You might have seen him pictured at some sporting events. He was at the Banrobe races last night, and he was asked about his time in Ireland so far and if he was enjoying it.
Well, you got to first look at the weather. Apparently, it's been raining for a couple of months. That's what I keep hearing. But since I've landed, it's been spectacular. Blue sky, 75 degrees. I've only been here 48 hours. I've already seen the Limerick tip game here at Banrobe today at the track. Big day here at Banrobe. So it's the hospitality has been amazing. The Irish folks, the Irish people love their sport. And, you know, I'm just having a blast.
What was the hurling like?
I actually enjoyed it. I watched a little bit. I downloaded GAA on my phone a few weeks ago, started watching some matches, tried to get a little familiar with the Limerick players. I know that's JP's favorite team. So, you know, got a chance to go to the game. And they call it the fastest sport on the field, and they are not lying. I was mesmerized. The athletic ability, the hand-eye coordination, physicality. I mean, the sport really wraps up a lot of things in one. And I'm a fan now. I really enjoy it. And I know they've got Cork in a couple weeks. I told the team I'm definitely watching. I'm gonna stream it from home and take it in. But amazing sport.
And it's great to see people getting behind sports like that. All the people who play for Limerick, they're from Limerick. Cork is the same. It's kind of unique.
We had my family was there. My wife, my daughter, my son flew in today. He missed a Limerick game, but a friend of his was with us. And so one of the things we all notice is just how much pride everyone has in their county, their colors. We watch folks walk for miles in, and then at the end of the day, Limerick wins. The kids storm the field. They surround their favorite players, autographs. I mean, just the pride that everyone had, and being an amateur sport and how much, you know, how important the Gaelic sports are to this country is pretty incredible. And so we kind of...
Jim Furyk hitting all the right notes.
Yeah, he was speaking to Dave Keena there. And what I really want to know from that is, what does Jim Furyk think of the GAA Plus debate?
He's all in favour of it.
He doesn't seem to mind paying the subscription to watch GAA on his phone, which...
One of the things they're talking about is putting the league final as a standalone fixture next year on Ryder Cup week. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's strange out of the GAA, because the GAA bows a knee for no one. The Katie Taylor wants to come and box in Croke Park, and there's this hullabaloo, and it's in negotiations upon negotiations to get a national treasure to play, to finish out her career, an absolutely unbelievable stellar career in her hometown of Dublin in Croke Park. And how much consternation. And now the GAA are willing to sacrifice their national sport and national league final on the same day that the Ryder Cup final is going to be on.
I think they're going to make it midweek.
I just think it's funny, and I think it just shows where the GAA's head is at when it comes to things like this. That, you know, whether it be, you know, incentivized financially or what, I'm not sure, but it just goes to show that they'll bow the knee to certain people, and then to their own, they'll turn their back on. And I just think it's distasteful. I think it's a little bit disrespectful to have another sport come in and to dominate and to move a game that's... All, like hurling is always, any league final, any hurling games have always been synonymous. It's been Saturday or Sunday. It's been Saturday or Sunday, always. And to move that and to bow down to someone, something else that's coming in, that doesn't sit right with me. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with it. I don't think we do it for anyone else or any other sport. Why now?
It's supposed to be in September. So the league final that is usually at the end of, February, is going to be in September, which it's completely out of the season. It's a competitive game that means something. What I don't understand about this is, why would they not just do an all-star game? It's at the end of the season. It's not a competitive game. Imagine tuning in. I would tune in to see the best players throughout the season picked in two all-star teams, playing together, lads who might play together in college, but can you imagine the Limerick lads, some of the Cork lads, some of the Clare lads, put the best Munster hurlers against the best Leinster hurlers?
They used to do that competition before, didn't they? The Munster versus Leinster, and then in the football they used to...
The Interpros.
The Interpros, And were they followed?
They were massive at the time, Like, they would have had huge crowds. Mm. Railway Cup.
That was the Railway Cup.
But, you'd get
but then it just disappeared.
You'd get a crowd for that in the same way as you'd get a crowd for the league game. I don't understand why it would necessarily need to be a competitive game for it to...
I presume it would be in the Gaelic grounds in the day before the opening ceremony type thing.
Yes, yeah.
And the Ryder Cup teams, Jim Furyk would come, and the wives in their matching clothes.
I think it'd be good. Genuinely. I would be on Chimps' side of things in terms of, I don't think you should ever move your season for the sake of another competition or another sport because you want to show us off to a few Yanks that are in the country, when you can do that anyway without sacrificing your actual competitive league and the competitiveness of your season. Because I think you'd get a crowd anyway. If you did an amateur game,
especially with the buzz that'll be around Limerick and the country as well once the Ryder Cup comes.
Do you think they should let Katie Taylor have Croke Park?
100%. I don't even understand the reasons why they're reneging and why they're saying that it can't be done.
I presume it's a finance thing. They want the promoter to pay, and he wants to get it cheap because she's a national treasure.
If it was to be hosted in Croke Park, then by all means. But like, even the fact that they were talking about it being the Katie Taylor being the undercard to Fury and Joshua, I don't know if that's still on the cards. But again, that takes away from the whole fact that the reason that we want it on there is because of Katie Taylor. Do you know?
I think that's gone now with the most recent.
Eddie Hearn said that if it's going to happen, it's going to be Katie Taylor headline.
A standalone event.
Yeah.
Which is on your right.
The other thing that's happened over the last few days, which I wanted to talk about here, is the enhanced games. All the newspapers are very critical of everything that happened. The back page of the Telegraph is "Doped athletes flop at steroid Olympics," and then "Australian juices to the gills and finishes last." It's like English newspapers laughing at Australian failures anytime they possibly can. It's always funny because, you know, generally Australia ends up beating the shit out of England, whatever it is that they decide to put their minds to. But anyway, the one thing that did strike me about this is that the two Irish swimmers made 175 and 250 grand in one night, which would be like a couple of years, if maybe not more than that, career earnings. And it's been written off as this like shambles, disaster. I think it's here to stay. I think that there's like a massive drugs company essentially behind it. We're trying to sell everybody, you know, the average person, the gift of enhancing your everyday life. And it turns out human beings want that shit.
It kind of goes hand in hand. I don't know if you're familiar with the term looks maxing. Have you seen that in popular culture
TikTok
these days?
Yeah.
It's a TikTok trend where basically people try to enhance every aspect of themselves from a beauty perspective. And I'd say this is kind of following in the similar vein. I don't know about you, Seamus, but like the younger generation in particular seem particularly interested and obsessed with fitness and gym. Like, you go into any local gym, it's packed full of 16, 17, 18 year olds. Seems to be where they hang out, as opposed to hanging out, what we used to do, hanging out in the fields, drinking cans, or going to the pub.
Yeah.
And fitness is the new obsession, and people trying to max out in every aspect. You hear 17-year-olds talking about, you know, their whoop score, their sleep score, and their recovery and all of this, and I don't know, it just doesn't sit well for me in a general sense.
No, it's worrying, and I feel like that generation as well, there's very little in moderation, that everything with that 15, 16, 17, 18-year kind of cohort, everything is like you're talking about looks maxing, everything's done to the max. So, and but don't get me wrong, like I agree with, like, Hyrox is massive now. You know, there's Tririca, there's all these different competitions. CrossFit has kind of taken over, and that's brilliant. That's amazing. Like, that's a really good way that you know, a cultural shift. You know, like, you look at any of my friends and anyone that I'm following on Instagram, like on a Sunday morning, instead of being hungover from the night before, it's that they're up doing a 10K run and their Strava scores coming up and posting it online. It's the bane of my life, but I think it's a good thing. But then there's the extremism of it as well, and you know, the enhanced games is definitely a factor of it, and they're playing into that then as well. They, like, these companies realize that, you know, kids are intrigued and invested in this. Okay, how can I bring my 10K down to whatever time? Okay, here's how you do it. And people start to dabble in it, and then your friends are doing it. And yeah, it's a slippery slope when it goes down that way. And the fact that all this stuff is, you know, it's being, you know, journalism, journalists are putting it out there. It's on social media. It's on every platform. What people look like, and you know, someone, all it takes is for someone to say, geez, wouldn't mind looking like that.
Yeah.
There was a GAA player a couple of years ago banned for a substance that was essentially a weight loss drug. It had a big, long name that I can't remember top of my head. That was sort of the first phase of all of this, where you see it and you do probably hope that it doesn't get to the point where these minor players or under 16 players are taking things that they don't know the long-term effects of, or buying things online that aren't properly tested and checked and see that they're safe. Like, you do really hope that this doesn't creep into the amateur game underage, so that they're trying to, if you're trying to get into the senior team, that you're trying to get any edge that you can.
But I could see how that could creep in as well, because there's so much of an onus on, you know, like even when I was playing, there was so much of an onus on your body composition. You know, okay, we're starting back in October, and this is your body fat score, this is your muscle mass, here's your overall weight, here's your BMI, and here's what you're going to target it over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Like, I could see a player coming into a senior setup and having, you know, a little bit excess body fat and saying to himself, okay, the only way I'm going to make it, or here's my target, I can't get to it naturally, here's how I'm going to get to it, and, you know, I'll pop a couple of fat burners, I'm going to take something like this to get me to where I need to be. And that's the start of it. Then the next thing is, okay, I need to put on a bit of muscle. Okay, I can't put on a bit of muscle. Okay, what can I take to put on that bit of muscle? How can I evade this? And that's the slippery slope that you start to fall down. And like, we're talking about amateur sports here then as well. Like, that's creeping into that. Like, professional sport is a whole different ball game. Whereas when that creeps into an amateur sport, on the sporting side, all of a sudden then it creeps into different lifestyles. And then that's when we talk about these young people getting affected by it. And it's scary, because there's a lot of pressure on people to look a certain way, and to, when you see all your friends and, you know, they're looking this way, there's a lot of pressure on people to look that way as well. And not alone in lifestyle wise, sports wise, if you see someone that's maybe taking something like this and is performing this well, okay, why wouldn't I give it a go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's the moral decision to cheat or not cheat used to be very black and white. You know, everybody who took something was evil, and that was the narrative. And the situation is always a bit more complicated than that. You know, there's always a grey area with these things. Like, those swimmers making more money in one night, we never asked the question of, like, why were they so badly paid for so long? The Olympic Games makes millions and millions, billions in terms of revenue, but it's not distributed to the people who are actually doing the sport and creating the excitement. And it's, there's just a rebalancing that's required, to the point where people are like, well, actually, why are you considering, why do you feel at the end of your swimming career, having represented Ireland, that you need to go and do this, which is going to taint your legacy in such a way, right? For the vast majority of people are going to look at that and go, I can't believe you did that thing. It's, you know, but there's definitely, I had to pause and go, well, why are they doing it? Like, why are they making this decision after competing clean for your entire career? And then at the very end, you go and you do this, and it's a show, and you're working for some of the, I would say, worst impulses of people who are creating these things, who are feeding on people's neuroses. Why are you being a show pony for them? And it's because they spent their entire time doing something, and they ultimately felt at the end of it there was no reward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's right, but there's a reason why some people make these decisions. And and I think the other side of it is that, like, the amount of money that there is for these drug companies and the people involved in selling these lifestyles, there's so much money in that this isn't going to go away. Some of the best athletes won't end up going the Olympic direction. They'll go this direction because you can win a million three times a year.
Yeah, for financial gain.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. And then I suppose my first experience was probably the Lance Armstrong era. and the outrage. And like to your point, Gerard, when you were talking about it being like black and white previous, it's an awful lot of grey area, you know. And he was doing it for a massive, huge financial gain. Like huge, so there was, I suppose what he was doing, there was benefit to it in his eyes to his doping, to using EPO. Whereas these athletes, okay, I can, like, if you're an athlete going into the Olympics, I can dope for the Olympics. Okay, I'm going to get caught. I won't get any financial gain. Whereas I go over here, I can legally dope. I can make a quarter of a million and come away and do that how many times a year?
Yeah. I like it, the thing about Lance was that they always would have said, well, everybody's doing this. Mm-hmm. That's the ball game. And if you're not doing it, you're a moron because the guys in the team next door are doing it and they're telling us they're doing it. So the rules of engagement, the well was so poisoned at that stage that they felt like they had no choice. And obviously everybody will say you did have a choice not to relitigate that. Will we talk about Jim McGuinness?
Yeah, let's do it.
It hasn't gone away, you know.
No.
So this is the Irish Times today. Stephen Rochford's column, Jim was in the wrong, but he deserves to be cut some slack. And Dennis Walsh on the same page, McGuinness will pay a heavy price for error of judgment. It's on the back of the Irish Independent, McGuinness and Clifford sweat over summer fate. Although there seems to be a consensus growing that Clifford won't face any punishment.
Mm.
Sorry, the back of the, in the Mail, it's, is there one law for Jer and another one for Jim? So there seems to be again a consensus that because Jer Brennan got done, Jim McGuinness has to get done. And I don't know if that's going to be the case. That seems to be what everybody thinks is going to happen. I'd say there's an Irish solution to an Irish problem coming here. No?
How can there be? Like if I was Dublin and Gerard Brennan and Jim McGuinness walks free, I would be livid. I'd be absolutely livid. And I'd be in every paper that I possibly could be, and Dublin GAA should be in every paper, because it's outrageous that any manager should be anywhere near or close enough to the opposing player to do what Jim McGuinness and Gerard Brennan did. It's outrageous that they got anywhere close enough to do that. And it's becoming a little bit of a culture in the GAA. Like you hear a lot of club games there, even last season, of, you know, parents coming onto a pitch with referees and stuff. And now it's stemming onto, like it's taken that little step further and on a larger scale on the inter-county scene, whereby managers actually are able to lay hands on players and are willingly doing so as well. And I get that, you know, what was it, a push or a shove or whatever, that's fine. But then if that's glazed over and that's, you, someone turns a blind eye to that, what happens next?
It's a punch at some point.
Exactly, you know. Exactly. And like Micheál Burns had thrown the first punch. Okay, he was in the wrong. But Jim McGuinness isn't the man that should take authority in that instance. That's Sean Hurston that needs to deal with that. And he did. He dealt with that. Jim doesn't need to be there. There's enough cameras on sports grounds to cover what's gone on. There's a CCCC review committee that are there to I suppose, retrospectively review games with anything that went on afterwards. Why does Jim McGuinness need to be in that position or put himself in that position?
Yeah, they got worked up, right? The two teams actually ended up getting sucked into a vortex of madness.
Yeah, and I understand that. Like, and that's the heat of the battle. But players deal with that week on week. You know, Jim McGuinness has played the game before, has managed Donegal before, has been in heated exchanges with Kieran McGeaney on a sideline, with different, like, you know, you've seen it in the Ulster Championship. It is that cauldron up there. I just don't understand why it spilled over onto the pitch and he had to point out what had gone on. He had the wrong man, number one. He was trying to point out Dermot O'Connor and saying that he was the one that instigated it all. So he was wrong in that instance, but I don't understand why he was there. Get your team down the tunnel and get in and get prepped for the second half and don't buy into what's going on.
Yeah.
Is there any justification when you see something as egregious as one of your players, the blood pumping, for you going in and trying to point out who you think was the instigator so that the referee sees it or that the linesman sees it?
None. None. It's not going to work, Jared. Genuinely, it's not going to work. Like, I've been in situations before where you're trying to tell, like, I've often got a yellow card and it'd be the wrong man that gets the yellow card, or you're in a schmozzle or a melee and, you know, someone throws a swipe, referee sees it from a different angle and you're saying to yourself, that wasn't me, but you still get the yellow. You're trying to plead your case. There's no good coming for it. I remember I made the point before, like, you should have a referee is pulling two linesmen that are probably, you know, referees on their day, and then you have umpires that are boys from his own club. If you bring in umpires that are there that are maybe referees on standby as well, there's enough of them around the country that you could put in on standby that see that. Then Jim McGuinness doesn't have to. If you bring in a fourth official that can that has access to that, if you bring in, you know, in essence, something like VAR or something like a TMO in the rugby that has access to that as well, that at halftime you can say, okay, this one's done at halftime. Sean Hurston can step away and say, let's go up to the review box and let's review this at halftime while the players are in doing their team talks for halftime. We'll review this and we'll see what went on and we'll deal with this after halftime.
It's funny you say that because I think that's what happened with Micheál Burns. Like, if Jim McGuinness didn't know who had punched Ryan McHugh and he was right there on the scene, the notion that a linesman saw it clearly and they wait until the start of the... I don't know. I'd say if... I wouldn't be terribly surprised if Micheál Burns ends up getting off, even though we all think he's guilty. But who actually witnessed that? And if they witnessed that but didn't see Jim... The one way you get off if you're Jim is that they saw it and they thought there was nothing in it and they dealt with it and they said, right, look, come on, lads.
There is the argument that you could say the referee did deal with it on the pitch. And look, I definitely see where the argument with Ger Brennan comes into it, but the referee dealt with Ger Brennan at the time, and that's one of the reasons why it was so difficult then for him to appeal the situation, because the referee made the decision, he sent them off, and then the automatic fallout of that is the 12-week ban, whereas in this, he didn't punish Jim McGuinness, he spoke to them at halftime, and the only person that was really punished in this situation was Micheál Burns for the punch. So it is going to be easier for Jim McGuinness than it was for Ger Brennan to get off here.
Yeah, and plus it sets a precedent as well if they're to go back on what the Sean Hurston's decision on field, and they're to give him that retrospective ban and overturn what Sean Hurston would say and the what him speaking to him on the pitch, that decision on the pitch not to issue any red or yellow card to Jim McGuinness. How do you overturn that? And then you open up that kind of worms of saying to people, okay, but this was the case in point where we did overturn it, and that's a slippery slope for GA to go down as well.
To your point though, like Paddy Andrews made this point on the Football Pod as well, that I'm just sick of, in general, managers, Mayor Iskas, people who aren't involved in the actual game, getting themselves involved in the game as a wider point. You see it at underage level, you see it at like the lowest levels of GAA, you see it at the highest levels, you see it in the Premier League. Managers and coaches and everyone on the bench involve themselves in the game when in reality it's the players on the pitch that should be dealing with that. Like, eventually it's going to peter out. If Jim McGuinness and the rest of the coaching staffs and subs on the bench and all of the people that got involved in this hadn't gotten involved, it would have calmed down and the ref would have dealt with it. And it wouldn't have blown up in the manner it did. So it's just one of those things.
But I think that's one of the points as well. Like, is that not Jim McGuinness's job? To get his players off the pitch at that stage, not instigate it further. Like him, if I was a player and I bought into Jim McGuinness, and he's such an emotive manager as well, like you play for Jim McGuinness, Jim McGuinness doesn't manage you, you play for him. And you see him so aggrieved on a sideline and finger pointing and all of this, you're going to get roiled up again. You know, that's you're going to see that and you're going to say, well, if he's that roiled up, something must have gone on. And you see it kind of, it had nearly died down at that and it flared right back up again afterwards. So you're saying to yourself, just get your players down the tunnel, get away from the situation. You know, you're in a really good position down in Clarendy playing really good football.
Oh yeah.
Get yourself away and get down. Don't buy into this.
Like we've been having this debate, can you have a statement victory without actually winning something? I'd say that's one of the few times that I was like, that was a bit of a statement win. You know, they hammered them. They
annihilated them. They've had two of them against Kerry this year as well.
In their back garden. Mm. Yeah, now the league final, take or leave, let's wait and see. Mm. None of them are going to have that medal as a special thing. They'll, you know.
Maybe Micheál Burns is just getting his one back from Michael Murphy's in the league final as well.
And he got away with it. So, like, imagine how aggrieved they must be feeling. Did Kerry, did they back off a bit? Did they fold up their tent in that second half?
It looked like it, but it looked like Donegal just didn't let them play. You know, like for David Clifford scored 4 points. 3 from play, which is, if you were to ask me any given day, David Clifford scoring 6-7 points of play easy. Just so well marshalled. Paddy was the very same, like this Donegal team, and I suppose you can read too much into this and you can say, well, they capitulated completely in the league final. Okay, yeah, that was the league final, this is probably the first meeting this year that meant something, but yeah, it looked like Kerry were saying, okay, this is gone from us. Similar to, I suppose, Leinster and Bordeaux at the weekend, in terms of this game is gone and let's just, you know, recalibrate and refocus. Let's play this out for whatever the 35 minutes that are left here and we'll refocus and reassess afterwards. Now, I know they were down numbers as well. You know, Sean O'Shea was a huge loss for them as well at the weekend. Still big players that they have to come back into that setup as well.
Yeah.
That they'd be heavily reliant on. But yeah, it seems like, you know, if they were to meet again this year, it would make for interesting viewing.
Yeah, well, it'll be spicy anyway.